You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 94. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today, we are talking about seeing the Hojo in anthropology. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dene Ta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Kendrick McCabe on the show. Kendrick is a cultural anthropologist receiving his BA in anthropology with a minor in psychology from the University of Alaska, and his MA in cultural anthropology from the University of New Mexico. He has been working with Parametrics as a cultural resource specialist and ethnographer for the past year and a half. He also has experience with ethnographic projects for the City University of New York, Navajo Nation Human Research and Review Board, and the Center for Southwest Research. Prior to his career in cultural anthropology, he was a behavioral health non-commissioned officer in the U.S. Army for 7 years. So welcome to the show, Kendrick.
Yate. Okay, I will introduce myself. He talked about earlier. Yate. She Kendrick McCabe Yenishia. Kiani Nishlin. Tis not Jenny Bushishin. Kiani Dushiche. Nakai Dena Dushinella. Shima Dushiche. Marlon Henry McCabe Jr. Well, yeah. Hi.
Hi. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm so excited to have you. It's nice to have someone on the show that has, well, Southwest ethnography experience, first of all. There's not that many of us. And, you know, such a good personal connection. So definitely we have to shout out to Sean Kelly. So
yeah.
Hi, Sean Kelly.
Hi, Sean. We got to go climbing. We keep saying it in the group chat.
Yes. Okay. Well, Sean Kelly aside, what got you interested in this kind of work?
Oh, man. I think so when I got out of the military, I had a pretty strong connection with a lot of the soldiers and kind of going to different units like infantry, radio, medical, and kind of getting to know them. And I felt like it helped me be better at my job. So I got out of the military because, you know, I have back injuries and a bunch of other stuff. But I was originally in engineering at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks in the interior. And I was doing engineering and it was fine. I was getting through my classes. I was kind of bored. And one day I found myself in the cultural center at the UAF campus. And in the cultural center was amazing. They have a bunch of like Inuit art and a bunch of artifacts and canoes hanging around. And I was just really curious. Also, they were making really small fry bread. I can't resist it. It was sweet like a donut, but it was great.
Huh.
And I sat down and I was trying to get up the courage to ask some questions because I just seeing different art and started talking to a few of the students. And then they were like, oh, where are you from? And I was like, oh, I'm Navajo from Arizona. And they're like, oh, you're our distant relative. And I was like, oh, yeah. Right. So, it brought in a lot of good connections. And then they started telling me more stories. And then I was really learning a lot. And then we hit a midpoint where it just got kind of really sad. There was a young woman. She had tattoos and she's trying to reclaim her culture. She had tattoos on her chin, on her arms. And I asked, I myself have a name given to me as a young Navajo person when I was born. And I've read that they have the same traditions. And I asked her, so you don't have to tell me, but what do you know your traditional name? And she just started crying.
Aww.
And she was like, I don't have that. We don't do that in my family. And I was like, that's horrifying. And I looked around at everyone else. I was like, do any of you know your traditional name? And they're like, we weren't given one. We don't do that anymore. And I was like, geez, it kind of broke my heart. And it made me kind of reflect a lot on, my time in the military and kind of talking to individuals. What does it mean to lose your identity? What does it mean to be in between worlds and feel, like an American? What does it mean to be in touch with your indigenous side? What does it mean to lose it? So I found myself in the anthropology building because I saw a flyer for research. And I ended up in one of the, I forget, the undergraduate research program. I forget the exact name for it, but I was in there and I got directed to Dr. Elaine Drew, who was my mentor, and told her about my thoughts, my idea. Like, I just wanted to kind of research with Navajo culture what does it mean to have a Navajo name, and what does it look like for children right now? Do they still have Navajo names? So, you know, she was a graduate student advisor, but she made an exception for me, and I'm immensely grateful to her. Aww. So she decided to take me on as an undergrad, and I went through the classes. I started to really love anthropology. Met some great professors. You know, it's just interesting. It was just all very interesting to me because it kind of fulfilled that travel and kind of new cultures that I was coming into contact with in the military that I was kind of lacking. So I left engineering because I was bored. I went to anthropology.
Which I'm sure your parents were very excited about.
Yeah, they really love all my decisions. Like, and I'm like, I'm joining the military. And they're like, oh my God. And I'm like, I'm deploying. Oh my God. Like, I'm going to Alaska. Oh my God. Yeah, they love it when I just tell them I'm doing the next thing. And, you know, they're very supportive. My mom is very into, very, very, she speaks Navajo fluently. She knows a lot of stories. She grew up at the tail end of like wagon use. And my dad is also very in touch with the spiritual side. So they were really supportive. And I did that project with the Navajo Nation Human Research and Review Board. And what I came away with some interesting takeaways. You know, Navajo usage of names for students at a particular school was on the rise. And from what I could tell, over a certain amount of years. And not only that, there were an interesting amount of biblical and Christian names. And I was wondering, like, is this something that I should check further with the Catholic churches around? And I located a lot of ledgers with Navajos losing, being given or forced upon their Christian names. Mm-hmm. And those ledgers are still in Navajo Nation. And then come to find out, the older ones are no longer in the Americas. They are now at the Vatican in Rome.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. And inaccessible.
Yeah.
You know, because they're essentially at the CIA. And and you know, it just kind of broke my heart. Like their whole identity taken away from them, or maybe mm-hmm. maybe in yeah. some cases, maybe willingly giving away. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it also kind of concerned me of like I was just focusing on Navajo names, but I thought, yeah, you know, Navajo culture. But then I started wondering, like, wait a minute, the aspect of being Navajo isn't just pure Navajo culture, if there is such a thing, but you can be Navajo and Christian, or you can be Navajo and Mormon, mm-hmm. or you can be a Mormon Navajo. Like there's so many different combinations right now. And I felt a type of bias is what I was coming into contact with of like, hold on, these individuals are also Navajo if they are also Christian. And they mm-hmm. deserve just as much consideration as to their identity as anybody looking at Navajo culture as in whatever, you know, original form they feel like it's in. So, you know, I came away very confused and really thinking about like my biases and just kind of confronting like that I feel like I was contributing to this purity notion, which is not good in anthropology, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, this yeah. Navajo purity notion, and becoming ethnocentric in my own Navajo culture. And that's how I got into this. And then just really reflecting on identity, my own identity. What does it mean to participate in different cultures? What does it mean to be a student? Learn. And then, you know, what does it mean to be a person in the world studying being a person in the world? And, you know, with everything that's been going on politically, apolitically, natural disasters and everything, I personally think there's a really strong need for anthropology right now to start mm-hmm. teaching each other to have curiosity and understanding each other.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. I am vigorously nodding my head.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, that's how I got into this. I very much love it. I love the chaos of it, especially mm-hmm. in the ethnography portion.
Yeah.
I very like, you know, I feel like if you tell people you're an archaeologist, they're like, oh my God, you're like Indiana Jones. Or if you're like, mm-hmm. I'm a revolutionary anthropologist, like, oh my God, you must dig up bones. But if you're like, I'm an ethnographer, and they're like, oh my God, what is that? What do you do? You ethnography. I'm like, yes. They're like, okay, what does that mean? I'm like, all right, well, I talk to people and, you know, I help them in understanding. I help bridge communication, help each other understand each other, at least in my regular work.
And, I tend to go for, I work in heritage preservation, and people are like, oh, okay. That one seems to like land a little bit more.
I really wish one day my mom would understand what I do.
We can all dream.
Yeah. She knows I visit with the tribes quite a bit and help push projects. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I just try to explain it. Like I really do a lot of tribal consultations and I do a lot of kind of cultural competency type discussions.
Right. If you're doing tribal consultation, that's more of like a mediator than heritage.
Maybe when my skill set starts to really expand as time goes on, I'll start doing more heritage preservation stuff.
Okay. So you did that project in college and you were trying to figure out, you know, if the way you were looking at things was contributing too much to this like purity. What's that's not the word. What is it?
Purity. Ethnocentric. Purity. Yeah.
Yes. Ethnocentric notion of your own culture. So where did you go from there?
So I graduated and then got a fellowship from the University of New Mexico. And I was like, okay, great. Yeah. I was really, really grateful for it. And I got down here to New Mexico and started working at the Maxwell Museum under the fellowship and taking my classes. And I really started to try and so I find social media to be amazing, primarily because it connects people really quickly and without many filters. What I started to see, you know, when I came back down here is there are so many different types of indigenous individuals. And, you know, everyone is doing it in some way and just being at campus, around town. But I was really concerning myself with how they were doing it online, because I feel like the online consumption is way faster. And I started to learn like, wow, there's Navajos who have, I don't know, I'm trying not to use like really hard slang. I'll have like amazing drip who are like dressing to the nines. There's Navajo who's really love to get dressed up and nice and wear bright colors and drive around Las Vegas and be indigenous in his Corvette, his big red Corvette. That's being indigenous to him. And there's another individual who kind of lives in various worlds as to their gender. They are both he and him and she and her and command a type of matrilineal presence and you know, is looking forward to their kinalta. And I thought, what are the cultural changes? I'm not sure how familiar you are with the kinalta. So a kinalta is a very important coming of age ceremony for young Navajo women. And this is a really well practiced in the Apache culture as well. There might be some variations as to amount of days and activities and things like that. But the idea is that she's now leaving her childhood and becoming a woman. And the transformation is holy, in which everybody is going to participate. One, to ensure that she has a good transformation, is prepared for life. And two, to also gain some of that holiness for themselves to be used for irrigation, crops, maybe even prayer. Or, you know, it could be something as like winning the casino. Like, it doesn't matter. It's all important to you. But the, you know, there's a whole ceremony centered around it. It's a young Navajo person who is they, them, and also she, he, and also he, him, whenever, you know, the time calls for it, is looking forward to their kinalta. Now, you know, I can't throw away the idea that, you know, the person has said they are a biological male, but they are also female. So it's fascinating to me that there are at least considerations to changing these ceremonies to better accommodate, you know, the person's situation. On the flip side of that, there are, you know, the comments on both on social media, both that are kind of in between, kind of confused, but also really uncomfortable with the idea of a biological male doing a kinalta, and then a very forward thinking, maybe considerate observation from individuals saying like, no, they are a woman. And then the discussion of like cultural stories of whether like there are variations of these things and, you know, gay individuals existing for this reason or gay or transgender individuals who shouldn't exist for this reason. And it like the stories are changed to some extent that it fits the need of the persons or the families. And, it, you know, that variation to me is quite interesting that it exists in proximity to each other. So like one person, one Hogan over might believe a completely different version of that story for their family member for whatever reason. So short, yeah, I was really watching online and just seeing how people were being indigenous and, you know, the matrilineal culture that it is being kind of influenced by Christian patrilineal culture is something I really try to watch as well. And yeah, I was just really examining all of this.
Okay. So I'm excited to hear more about how that tied in and more about what you were thinking after noticing all of this. And we will come back to that right after the break. Okay. So we were just talking about social media and all of the cultural, I don't know, diversity sounds not quite right. But yeah, like
I think it's the closest
ways of approaching. Yeah.
I'll figure out, like, I'm in the process of trying to figure it out. So at some point when if I ever publish about this, then I think I'll come to something, but it might not be in English, that term, but we'll see.
Yeah. Is there a term not in English that you can think of?
Well, I don't know. Like, I don't know if it's even going to be Dene or Denepezad. It's so difficult because like, it's so difficult. I'm trying to figure out how to say a word that implies an action. So so when I was in Seattle for the company gathering, you know, everybody, I really like this exercise of like, if I say, do you know what the word, plechai is?
No.
What is it? What does it make you? It
sounds like, yeah.
What is it? What do you, what is it? What comes to mind when you hear that word?
I bet there's going to be like an obvious tie-in, like either it sounds like something, right? Or like it is, you know, like the sound that something makes or the sound or like sounds like an English like adaptation, or maybe it's like, I don't know. I'm trying to think. Nothing's coming immediately to mind.
So loose handly, or at least a more looser version of it is like, it means dog.
Huh. Okay.
So on the res, on the res, you'll hear everyone, you know, point to a dog and like that's, you know, that's dog.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean dog. It describes what the dog is doing.
Oh, okay.
So it's like saying it poops everywhere.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a pooper. It's a pooper. it's more of an annoyed word, you know, like it's pooping everywhere. Like that's what that means. So when I was in Seattle, I was telling my peers, like, what do you think klitschai is? And they were like, it sounds like a beautiful word. I'm like, and I started laughing. I was like, oh yeah, what do you think it means? And they're like, I don't know. I was like, I'll just tell you, it means dog. And they're like, oh, okay. I was like, dude, what do you think it means? Like, what do you think that how it's describing the dog? Like, I don't know, like loyal animal, you know. It's very, very, you know, like they're just going on their own experiences with dogs and what they've been told, man's best friend and all these things. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, and I told them, I was like, it means it poops everywhere. an annoyed person saying, like, it's pooping everywhere. And they started laughing. So I don't know a word that can describe that type of being. I'm sure one exists, but also because like, it's kind of like saying, because I'm trying to find a word that describes the action of that, but there's not really there is a general Navajo orthography, but I feel like it's not really substantiated. It's very gendered in some ways.
Okay.
So I I don't know. Maybe it's worth it to workshop, because we can create new words.
Uh-huh.
And it's not totally difficult to do, but I want to find something that describes that process and not necessarily describes it from viewpoint, from the person who's being that. And I think that belongs to them. And you know, the diversity of that, to me, at least diversity of language, is what's kind of necessary. I don't think there's a wrong way to say anything, as long as you're doing it with intent. But, you know, there's an age old kind of discussion of like, with like, say, coffee, is it ahue or gohue? Well, they're both correct. But then you'll run into older Navajos that are like, it's ahue. I'm like, yeah, it is. And then, but then they'll correct also, younger Navajos. Yeah. And they'll be like, they'll look at younger Navajos and be like, it's not gohue. I'm like, no, it is also gohue. Like, both are correct. We're around the coffee. they understood you. There's no reason to hold on to, you know, the non-changing. And I don't know. There's just something about individuals who are doing indigeneity their own way online that is amazing. It's kind of, I think until very recently, it was really difficult to do that because you're kind of under elders and kind of doing it the way they want you to do it. And, you know, and unfortunately through generational trauma and, you know, the persistence of colonialism, you know, a lot of younger individuals are kind of out of touch and told they're not enough and told that they aren't indigenous for whatever reason. And it could be something as trivial as like skin color, which to me is insane that you don't look the part, but unfortunately people hold a lot of importance about looks. And what I started to at least come to terms with, and kind of workshop with my committee at UNM is this kind of notion of they're doing it and what is the social purpose and how would that look in a framework in anthropology? And, you know, I think a lot of the frameworks apply, but additionally, I also think that framework probably needs to come from those that are doing the thing. That are being in these worlds and doing these social work, they need to describe the framework, I think. And, you know, I think a general understanding of anthropology, you know, maybe if anthropology can ask to be driven to understanding instead of being in the seat, in the driver's seat, I think that would be ideal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's, you know, the concept of doing to me, like if you're doing it in some way, you know, and there are certainly, I do a lot of consultations and there are wrong ways of doing it that, you know, some people are just not aware of because nobody taught them or nobody stopped them and said, hey, don't do this.
Like
there was one instance, unfortunate instance. And, you know, I hope it gets better over time, but I'm not sure how familiar you are with Cherokee Indian Princess Syndrome.
Yes.
Okay, so I have sat in meetings and, you know, with individuals of certain, I guess, higher ranking city officials and state officials and such. They, you know, they don't know how to communicate. I hate to say it, but it's almost like they just don't know how to talk to brown people because they're not around them often. Mm-hmm. It's like, what do I even say? So they try and latch on to something that's familiar. You know, oh, you like golf? I like golf. Oh, you like video games? Right. I like video games. And, you know, when all the tribal members give their introductions, they are very powerful because they're willing to speak their language, introduce themselves as they grew up with. And it's a lot of, you know, it takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of courage to be able to do that. But when one individual who's like, gives his instructions and it was fine, but if he says, oh, and by the way, you know, I have a granddaughter back, you know, she just had her blood test and she's, you know, so, and you can see it in her face. Like, so we still have Indian blood in the family. I'm like, oh God.
Oh.
And then you can, you know, a good observer will see the collective drop of the head in all the tribal members and then see the immediate loss of respect. And then, you know, I'm just kind of like, all right, well, you can't say that again. You know, blood quantum itself is a really sensitive topic.
Right.
And you know, some a lot of tribes do it. Some tribes don't even do that. Some of them make you take a test. And,
yeah,
and, you know,
it's nation and versus blood. Yeah.
Yeah. Nation versus blood. They'll have you recount an oral history story or talk about your family. Right. Or maybe you speak the language. Like, there are so many ways to demonstrate personhood that are unique to tribal members and then unique to their own families. So it's this act of being an indigenous person. Like, what does that look like? I think it looks like a lot of things. You know, we can probably very easily come up with obvious things. It's, you know, skin color, it's look, it's location, language, maybe food. But then there are some really subtle things. It's like, what name are you using when you send your emails? What kind of greeting are you doing? Where are you eating? What are you cooking in your own home? Like, there are very subtle things. What is your family like? How are you telling your jokes? What history do you have with your grandmother? Like, they're all of them to me are very valid and make up a person's indigeneity. And I, what I find concern with is when individuals who are indigenous look at another indigenous person and are like, you are not us. And I find that kind of odd because I feel like, and I worked this out with my professor, Dr. Lane Drew, Dr. David Dinwoody, and Dr. Christina Jacobson, this idea, this notion of it, the person that is not is is just as important as the person who is.
Right, right.
The like, if you are an indigenous person who speaks your language, the person who is trying to speak their language, who may not have it yet, is just as important to your identity as you believe it is.
Right, right.
So you have to find some sort of appreciation in that they don't have what you have and vice versa.
Right.
And
or it may have been taken from them.
Or it may have been taken from them or you know, it may even be around. It may be kept from them in some cases.
Yeah.
And those some of those stories are just really sad to hear. It's like, no, I have a few peers here who are trying to reconnect with their indigeneity. And it is also heartbreaking, the diaspora of indigenous people, younger people who, so there was another instance at the university, you know, in the classroom, Dr. Jacobson's classroom, who's an amazing applied anthropologist. We were talking about native names and I was just kind of going through the process of how young men get their names. And typically it's with their coming of age ceremony. And, you know, that could, if they did something notable, but also a lot of times in contemporarily, when young people are given their names on like the reservation, you know, they're the parents that decide right then and there, if they haven't been thinking about it, it's like, here's a book, pick a name. But from what the cultural stories say, it used to take like 2 weeks to a month to the elders and the family had to watch this baby, see what they were like, observe them, and then they got a name. And a lot of the times, you know, you're given two names, a sacred name. You can't tell everyone. I'm convinced that, you know, you can't tell anyone because they don't want you want it taken away from you. And it's only for spiritual usage. And then you're given your colonial name, which, you know, is not said often, but that's what it is. And it's fine. The aspects of naming is important. There are whole ceremonies around naming. And when I was with those students, I happened to talk about their names. And then I talked about, you know, young women getting their names in the Hogan, just as an explanation. And then one of the younger men was like, can men get, and he was not like, this is all mostly Navajos who grew up in the city. And he raised his hand and was like, can Navajo men get names? I was like, yeah, they can. He's like, how do you get a name? And I was like, just so I can get an idea of this, how many of you have a Navajo name? And none of them raised their hand.
Whoa. Okay.
It was wild. And I was like, how many of you knew that that existed? And none of them raised their hand. I don't know what it feels like to not grow up on the reservation. you know, I'm really grateful that I had access to my grandparents. I've met a few individuals here in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, who have such unique stories of being diaspora, of coming from families who have given up their mother for adoption, and then their mother gets married to, I don't know, a white family, and, you know, has their child, and then there's this disconnection with each other, like this child, you know, a peer of mine, she can't go back to the reservation and feel welcomed because there's this collective shame on that side of the family that they gave up her mother. And then my friend is upset with them for giving up her mom. And, you know, and then nobody wants to talk about this trauma. They just want to brush it on the rug and pretend like it never happened. And unfortunately, I think that's, you know, there are many contributors to drug use, methamphetamines, alcohol abuse, depression, anxiety, suicide on reservations. But to me, not being willing to talk about your family story in that way is what contributes to, you know, destruction of the family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I run into a lot of situations like that. So so when I find individuals who don't have that stab that I was given as a kid and grown up with, it's just fascinating. And it's also sad that they're just trying to find themselves.
So I have a question. So thinking about, like, going from, you know, obviously there's the Cherokee Princess syndrome, you know, the example with the guy that you mentioned in the consultation. Mm-hmm. And then obviously there's, you know, people who, so for example, I'm thinking of a friend who's on one side, you know, both of her grandparents are, you know, were tribally enrolled, but this person was raised in a city. And so very, like, you know, has conflict about, like, whether or not to consider themselves indigenous, basically.
Mm.
And so, like, you know, thinking about what you're talking about, like, that you, on the one hand, like, obviously everybody feels uncomfortable by that person who's like, my third great grandmother was Cherokee.
Look at her cheekbones. You could see it right there. She had the straightest exactly. black hair that you would ever see west of Mississippi. I'm like, okay.
Right. Yeah. So where does it, like, where's the line, I guess, between like someone who, like, genuinely is like, I don't know, you know what I'm saying? Or you know what I'm asking?
I do. I think it's effort. I think it's effort to learn. Mm-hmm. I've met a few individuals who are really motivated. They actually have gone through census records, tracked down which side of the reservation their family came from, seen ledgers, as you know, and some of these individuals look very, you know, whatever look indigenous means, but also some also don't look indigenous, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they want to reconnect, and they'll go out to the reservation and see if they can find someone who knows a story about their grandparents, see if they knew them. I really enjoy those stories. I really enjoy the stories of, like, hey, I do have a connection, and this is how I know. You can, like, here's a picture. Okay, the picture, here's their family. Their family lives here, and they were tribally enrolled here, and they, you know, were taken off the reservation from here. And I've learned some of the words, and I've started to learn to cook. And then because it, you know, it takes effort even to just, you know, if you have very much see yourself indigenous, it takes effort to stay indigenous. It's you know, we have to continuously practice it. And you know, I myself don't really like the idea of confronting somebody and say, you're a pretendian.
Yeah.
But I also don't think.
But I mean, there are some people that are, right?
There are. I don't like doing it. I have confronted that, and it has, you know, led to some damaged relationships. Mm-hmm. And I've confronted it bluntly, and I've confronted it tactfully. I've only ran into one person who was really offended that, well, they tried to use their quote unquote indigeneity as a Republican political ploy. But after a little bit of questioning, they just broke down. And they were like, you know what? And then they became racist.
Oh,
it was kind of odd. I was sending. So this
wasn't
this,
that odd.
it was really odd. This person.
But if they're already like making up. Anyway, sorry, I'm cutting you off now.
It was odd because this is a person I served in the military with. And I did not quite expect it to go this way. And, okay. You know, this conversation was happening over text message and I was taking screenshots and sending it to two other friends of mine. And they're like, wow, he's racist. I was like, yeah. So we just never saw that person in the same light again. And
I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know, he's then he tried to run for president and failed cataclysmically. But anyway. But I have also, you know, not I don't like I said, I don't like doing it, but it doesn't mean I will not do it. I did have a conversation with a good classmate in the same class because he did introduce the idea that, you know, he had Indian blood. He said that he had a picture of his grandmother and that she was Native American and, you know, from the Cherokee clan, from the Cherokee people. And, you know, I don't want, this person is really nice. He's really sweet. He is a Navy vet. He's such a great person. And I didn't want him to walk into a place with a bunch of indigenous people and then make a mistake. Like, I didn't think he deserved that. So I was like, okay, well, let me talk to my professor and see if I can approach him. And I did. And he was very gracious about it. He didn't come to the next class and I felt so bad, but he came to the next one after that and he apologized to the entire class. He said, this was a story that I was just told in my family. They tell each other this and I've never actually seen this picture and I'm starting to question it now. And I'm really sorry if I caused any harm of your own indigeneity and what does it mean to actually claim this? And I'm just, apologize. It was great. It was so great.
Yeah.
So, you know, that just kind of proved the fact that it can be talked about bluntly and very tactfully and people can learn and, being at least trying to reclaim your indigenous heritage is a process and it's uncomfortable. And, you know, you might even get to the end, you have to kind of make peace with the idea that you may get to the end of that road and find like, oh, there's nothing here. But I mean, also maybe you're led to a different path and you see like a different history and that might be exciting too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Hmm. Okay. Well, on that really interesting note, we're going to have to take our second break and then we will jump right back in for our third segment. Okay. Back from our break and I wanted to talk about what you do at Parametrics now. I'm really like interested to hear more about the work that you guys are taking on. You know, as an ethnographer in the Southwest, I'm always like interested to hear what's happening with other ethnographers in the Southwest. So,
oh man. So, you know, when I started in 2023, like a week after I graduated, it was kind of a whirlwind learning experience.
Yeah.
You know, Sean gave me kind of a crash course in how this works in the applied anthropology world. And it was a lot. There were a lot of big projects going on. And, you know, the ethnography program itself in Parametrics had a few facets. And there was definitely some collaborative work within Parametrics that was kind of, there was also DEI initiatives. And then on top of that, TCP studies in Colorado with the Army Engineering Corps. The Navajo Gallup Water Supply Project and, you know, the some other TCP studies with some of the other tribes and then some Navajo, some Navajo Nation ethnographic things that needed to be addressed. So, you know, after the really great guidance from Sean and his continued guidance in his new role, I found myself kind of taking on a learning curve. My supervisor, Jeff Verdeen, was really great at kind of introducing me when Sean left and then working in tandem with Cher Churchill and Greg Master Pietro. And then the rest of the EPNC team was great because they were really just, you know, helping me chug along and learning my role. I did got into the Navajo Gallup project, started to get into just talking with the tribes, and then managing communications, checking, doing consultations with them. We're trying to help them get set on their mitigation projects, and then learning about ArcGIS, learning about how to organize meetings, things to think about, and then trying to ensure that meetings go well. How to kind of introduce topics. I did get contacted to do one uranium project, an ethnography in Lukuchikai, on the Navajo Nation, in the Chaska Mountains. And that was really great. You know, it's kind of my first solo one. And, you know, the project entailed talking to residents, 8 of them, to get thoughts on a remediation project, mitigation procedures, their own experiences. What do they consider cultural properties? And so, you know, I got so excited. I was like, wow, my first ethnography project. I got my recorder, got my camera, got my little bag. And I was like, I've been training my whole life for this. And, you know, went down to Lukuchikai. I talked with the residents. I really like the idea of like the chaos in ethnography. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've done a few projects where I'm just like led from one person to another. I have to go over here, go over there. There's this person, there's that person. Yeah. And it's exhausting, but it's so exciting. And everyone
always
was
interesting.
Really, yeah. And, you know, I really enjoyed it. The project itself was great, but the stories were just really heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, families had stories of walking, of their fathers walking into mines and bringing that dust back home with them, shaking off dust and hogans, getting sick from it, family generational cancer. And then still seeing like items from the mines around the Chuskas, and then some concerns about drinkable water. It was a lot.
Wow.
And
yeah,
just seeing this little community, what it's been through since the uranium mines were started, and then hopefully getting their own closure with their Superfund effort to pay them out for their continued health issues. And just hearing about, you know, and it was, these individuals are dealing with cancer. And then, you know, COVID happened, and that just exacerbated their issues. And then just some concerns of like education efforts, just not really being aware of how dangerous uranium is. And in some cases using it to just prop doors open because it looked cool. Like it's just not just really kind of bad. I don't know what to call it. Just really sad stories. And, you know, the community grateful and I'm hoping, you know, these changes get implemented that they suggested, but just have to wait and see. I feel like the CRM world, you know, when it comes to you to do your part, you're like really fast at it. And then it's kind of just waiting until things, you know, kind of catch up. And the decision makers based on financial budgets and inflation and I don't know, however all those decisions are made, finally go in. Ensure that these things are implemented and disseminated in a manner that is accessible by the community. You know, there were certain areas where I was like, wow, I don't have signal here, or I'm not receiving text messages, or I can't like get on YouTube or internet or whatever. And, you know, some of them were just like, hey, if you like, you know, we don't go to the chapter house, so we don't hear these discussions, but, you know, they all still, some of them still use radio. So maybe it'd be better to just go to KTNN and have them, you know, broadcast those results to the elders. So that way they can hear it in Navajo of like, hey, this is what they're doing. Some of them are kind of unaware of what was going on. So it just seems like information dissemination is one of the bigger things of engaging the community.
Yeah.
I really don't like showing up and they're unaware of any of this. And then, like you go to the chapter house and it's just like one paper posted to a bulletin board, like among a lot. It's you know, like it's your one document that's on the bulletin board along with bashes, tires, missing persons, awareness of meth. Like you kind of get lost. That can't be your dissemination process to just go put a form on a board and say you did it. That's insane.
Yeah.
So, you know, just making making recommendations of like, hey, you probably have to go house to house. At least that's been like the best way that I've been able to get some good information and good feedback of how important this mountain is. And it wasn't just from, you know, Navajo practicing individuals. It was also Navajo Christians. Like there were a lot of biblical references to that mountain, to that range that was important to them. So I thought, okay, well, I can't just say Navajo culture. I got to put Christianity and Mormonism in there too, because that's, you know, they're just as part of the community as everyone else is.
Right.
And then, you know, working on these water projects, learning the archaeology, quick, fast, and in a hurry, learning what is, you know, what is a right of way, seeing maps in ArcGIS of like what's recommended, 75 feet, 100 feet, 50 feet, as far as like avoidance, reburial practices. It's a lot of information, especially for, you know, someone like I've not done CRM before, mostly just stuck with theory and doing my own little ethnographic projects on my own with other academic entities. But yeah, and then just trying to bring like a culture of awareness within parametrics. Uh-huh. And they're very culturally competent already. And they're very sensitive to these issues, you know. The archaeologists, at least here in New Mexico and Seattle and California, Utah, they're very considerate of, you know, they're very considerate of the idea that they may not know, which I think is a great place to start.
That's half the battle.
It is just being like, you know what? We don't know. We should probably go to the experts. What a crazy idea. Why would you do that? Maybe we should go to the people who live there. And, you know, we have like monthly meetings, and this idea actually came from the mutual person we were talking about at a Pueblo of Acoma of doing a tribal panel. And, you know, she was really excited. And then, you know, I asked them, like, is this something you want me to pursue? Like, this is an idea. And they were like, yeah, you should try it. So, you know, I got one of the other Pueblo and Tipos to agree to do it. And we also were able to bring a Tipo member, Tipo from the Kwalyu tribe in Seattle, to also attend the tribal panel.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because, you know, there's such different environments and they're dealing with different issues. And, you know, I feel like there's a utility in being able to talk to each other and being able to know that you're all working with parametrics in some capacity. And the way I kind of, you know, I met with them prior to that, along with the tribal communities of practice in parametrics. And, you know, myself, Maeve Harris, who's an amazing engineer, and then Susan Devine and Happy Longfellow, we all met with the tribal members and let them know, like, hey, this is kind of an opportunity that we feel would be great. You know, when I've been in these projects, I've noticed a concern with the tribes persons that they don't get to talk to like the engineer, one person who's designing the road or the right of way. That's not built into our utilization. Like there's no task order or charge code for, you know, tribal engagement or tribal concerns. So I kind of let them know, like, I can't speak for the other entities, and maybe, you know, a lot of them have their own tribal engagement or cultural competency ways, but I really don't like the idea that I, a Navajo, am filtering the concerns of other tribes. Because I feel like I need to be aware of how I think can see the land.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe it'd be best for them to talk to everyone at Parametrics. We have these things called lunch and learns, and you know, it's where we kind of try and do like cross training. If you're an engineer and you come to like an archaeology one, or you're an admin person who is listening to IT, like that's a really great. At least I find them very helpful. So I told the tribes, like, you can speak to everyone at Parametrics. It's engineers, archaeologists, environmental planners, you know, equity That's individuals, awesome. Admin, payroll, in whichever way you feel is comfortable. And here are the questions that I've kind of synthesized that kind of detail your concerns. You know, how to think about the land, what kind of mindset should you be in, what are some legal concerns, what are your best practices you remember, and what are some bad practices you remember. And you know, so they very graciously came to our lunch and learn. And I don't remember how many, it was a good majority of the company that was there. And, you know, the tribes got to say how they felt directly, unfiltered. Yeah. I was there for it. Everybody was listening. They, you know, you would think one of the ideas of tribal engagement is not only just to, you know, be aware that they exist and they're on the land, but also there's a financial incentive as the tribes say to save money. So they don't have to come back later with redesigns. If they say no, they can also help you avoid issues because they know the land. And, you know, just engaging with the tribes early in the project will certainly help firms, state and federal entities avoid issues down the line. And, you know, and then just kind of giving their own thoughts on the land. What does it mean to them? And it's really, you know, it's really hard to synthesize just how connected the land is to their language, to their well-being, to their mental health. And I, you know, and this process, at least I think, was important to say, especially for them, this process of separating what is important is actually harmful. Telling tribal members like, hey, pick the most important sites is a harmful process.
Yeah.
It's like looking at your family burial plot and being like, we can only keep four. Which is the most important part. Yeah. It's like if you're, you know, a non-Indigenous person, and you're looking at your family burial plot, you can only keep four of the five family members. Pick which family member can't stay here. Choose the most important one first.
Yeah.
That's what it's like. And these individuals grew up on the land, and when they have to go and participate in this way of, hey, is this site more important than this site? That puts an emotional toll on them that they have very willful, they have very courageously engaged in.
Yeah.
And I hope, you know, whoever listens to this understands that it's not pick and choose. That's not what happens. Additionally, I know we work in a culture of like, hey, don't bring your work home with you. The tribes can't do that.
Right.
They cannot. It's on their minds all the time. They cannot just leave their work at home. They work at their home is the land. They work. That's where they work. They can't just go home and, you know, I don't know, turn on Real Housewives of Atlanta and just pretend like they're not concerned about the sites that they now have to go and pick and choose, figure out the ones that are more important than the others, because it's all important.
Mm-hmm. And it affects their personal relationships too.
It does. It affects their personal relationships. It affects their intertribal relationships.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's sticky.
Yeah, it gets really sticky, and I'm really grateful the times that they're very gracious to each other and patient with each other. And, you know, to me, that the good relationship building is really necessary, and not just showing up and being like, hey, we're here to work on infrastructure projects. But if you're invited to a feast day or something, go, I think. In our culture of work, we get really we rather say colleagues, and we'd rather say, I don't know, interlocutors. And we'd really shy away from saying friends. And I think in order to better work on these projects, you have to go and make friends with your, I don't know, as they say, stakeholders, but the individuals who these projects actually affect. And, you know, go have dinner with them. Go sit and eat. Don't talk about archaeology. Like, get to know them on a personal level. Like, do they have
their dinner?
Pay for their dinner. Like, God, like, just like, look. So if you're going to go and, like, you know, do ethnography, please, like, pay your participants a gift card. Please pay your tribal participants. Don't show up and be like, oh, they live on the land and this project's for them, so they should talk to me. Like, no, they are giving their time.
I get paid.
But like, I get paid whether or not, whether I get information or not. But the individuals who are gracious with their time, please give them something. And, you know, it might not always be cash. It might be, I don't know, they might need like flour. Be open to these different ways of, you know, that don't feel businessy.
Yeah. Or bring them some food you've made.
I don't know. Have dinner with them or something. Yeah. And you know, participate in the cultural project. I promise if you go and participate in a feast day and then like go and have dinner, see the family, see the people that this land is most important to, and they're in their in their own cultural activities, like you'll start to understand. It'll make sense why you're doing these things. And, you know, and it'll help with burnout. Like, I feel like there's so many projects and I know the tribes themselves get really tired. And, you know, every like, I don't know how many Microsoft Teams you have, but I have a lot. and you know, sometimes like a lot of help is too much. Like, it's like, here's this Microsoft Teams for, you know, shape files. Here's this Microsoft Teams for communication plans. Here's this Microsoft Teams for best practices. Like, it's just, it's a lot. And, you know, sometimes they, you know, it's going to take a couple of days to get a hold of them. But once you start building those connections, like, it's worth it. It's very worth it to see the work you're doing.
Wow. Well, on that note, we are right at the end of our time. But I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's great to get a chance to chat with you. I've been hearing so many good things.
Oh,
so yeah. So excited we got the chance to talk, and yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.